to left corner to Aguila. Aguila to the left circle. Passing to Yale. A shot. Save made by Aguila. Rebound. Another shot. They score! The Flames win it! Yeah, baby!
They score!
And the sea of red erupts.
Flames Talk starts now on Sportsnet 960 The Fan. Here's Pat Steinberg and Aaron Vickers.
All right. Happy Tuesday. Welcome to the final day of April. We are underway. It is Tuesday, April 30th from our Doug Lacey's Basement Systems downtown studio with Steinberg and Aaron Vickers on this Tuesday. Hello, Vix.
I don't know how you always catch me unaware of the day of the week or the date. Like, I had no idea it was April 30th until you mentioned it. Now I'm a little rattled.
Half the time I get the date wrong or the day wrong, so don't take my word for it, but I do believe there's 30 days in April.
Correct.
And this is the 30th of the 30 days. Lots to talk about this hour. Frank Saravalli, our daily face-off NHL insider later on this hour. Lots of coaching news around the league right now. We found out on Monday, Dave Hakstol out as head coach of the Seattle Kraken. Sounds like on this Tuesday, some buzz around Mike Sullivan's future and maybe that being up in the air with the Pittsburgh Penguins. So some interesting coaching news around the NHL. And I think that gives us a good opportunity to talk about the head coach of the Calgary Flames and look back on year one of Ryan Huska behind the bench for the Flames. How do we evaluate year one of Ryan Huska coaching the Calgary Flames? Thought today would be a good day for us to dive in on that with all the coaching news around the NHL. Get your texts in at 960-960. Would love to hear your thoughts on Ryan Huska's first year behind the bench and assessing the strengths, the positives, the negatives. Honestly, Vix, I thought he did a really solid job in his first year behind the bench. Difficult circumstances, taking over for the person he was taking over for. I mean, Daryl Sutter is a larger-than-life, kind of almost mythical figure in this city, and that's who Ryan Huska was taking over for behind the bench, and it was a year with a first-time general manager. All kinds of distractions right from the very first day of training camp. There were nothing but distractions for this Flames team. And honestly, I thought he did a really nice job of navigating the waters, keeping things on the rails. And then as the year went along, you know, things got even more difficult and those waters got even choppier with trades and trade requests and all of what went into this season, putting rookies into new spots, so on and so forth. Honestly, if I'm making a blanket statement, Vix, I think Huska did a really solid job in year one behind the bench. I'm curious as to if you were to just blanket it, how would you evaluate year one?
I would call it a net positive with everything that he had to deal with. You have outlined a fair bit of it. Let's just talk quickly about the volatility of being a head coach in the NHL. 10 of them were fired this season. That's 10 of 32. Jay Woodcroft in Edmonton, Dean Evason in Minnesota, Craig Berube in St. Louis, DJ Smith in Ottawa, Lane Lambert with the Islanders, Todd McClellan, Lindy Ruff, Don Granato, David Quinn, Dave Hakstol. You mentioned Mike Sullivan might be on the chopping block. That makes Bruce Cassidy, hired by Vegas in June 2012, the longest tenured head coach in the division, which is crazy to me. Pivoting it back to Ryan Huska, I can't imagine a scenario
you
where
just
he
really
asked
wanted
that.
To, you just
I really wanted to run
really
through that
wanted
list.
To get that list.
I got about halfway through. I'm like, I need to speed this up. This is dreadful. But back to Huska, I thought he did a really good job, all things considered. And listen, year over year, last year with Daryl Sutter behind the bench, this year with Ryan Huska, same number of wins, so stagnant on that front. A 12-point drop. They finished 17 points back of Vegas for that final wild card spot. But you can't really look at it on paper given the circumstance. He had to reset a lot of things Ryan Huska did, reset the playing style, particularly in the defensive zone, reset the culture, and essentially all season long, you talked about navigating the waters when it comes to trying to park the distractions or keeping everything outside of the room. There was almost a full roster reset in terms of the departing six UFAs from Tyler Toffoli in the offseason right to Chris Tanev right up in front of the trade deadline, like Noah Hanifin, Nikita Zadorov. The list goes on, Elias Lindholm. That is a lot of turnover for a coach to navigate.
Yeah.
And I think he did, to be quite honest, an admirable job of dealing with all the outside circumstances while still trying to reset the Calgary Flames.
Here is, before we dive in on the specifics and really get into year one behind the bench for Ryan Huska, text line, as I mentioned, is open at 960-960. This is General Manager Craig Conroy when he sat down with us on Locker Cleanout Day. Asked him about year one working with Ryan Huska and the job he thought his first year head coach did.
The attention to detail, what he wants to do, you know, the way he wants to play. I love his interviews. I like the way he treats the players. He did for a first year. I couldn't have asked. I couldn't be more happy, to be honest. There's always things. There's probably things he wants to do differently. There's things that I want to do differently. I learned from, but it is a learning curve. You're going to make mistakes, just like a young player is going to make mistakes. You're like, oh, okay, I won't do that again. But I thought our relationship was rock solid, you know, easy to communicate back and forth, and like I said, a pleasure to work with.
So Craig Conroy, very positive reviews for year one, and let's not forget that Ryan Huska was Craig Conroy's guy from the get-go, and that's not to say that some of the other people who were interviewed for the job to replace Daryl Sutter weren't given full consideration, whether it was Mitch Love or some of the other names that entered the conversation. But I believe that Craig Conroy's guy, even when he was going through his interview process, the guy that he had in mind if he were to get the job was Ryan Huska. Those two guys have kind of worked together and been in lockstep with one another as assistants or lower spots in the organization since Ryan Huska joined the organization in 2014, when he became the head coach of the, what were they called then? The Adirondack Flames, Adirondack, whatever they were, the team in Glens Falls, yep. New York. He's been with the organization not quite as long as Conroy has in management, but now these guys have worked together and been communicating with one another and been very tight for quite some time. And I think Ryan Huska was the guy that Craig had in mind and was going to go through an exhaustive search, but in the end decided to go with the guy that he had a lot of faith in, or the most faith in, and that's Ryan Huska. And so year one, you know, I think that there's going to be the requisite disagreements that go along with any relationship in the NHL, but I thought that, you know, the working relationship as described on both sides from him was very strong. And I think that what Craig Conroy just said there, you know, the biggest strength for me that I took away from Huska's first year behind the bench was how the team played for him. And I think one of the constants, if you were to look back on this season, one of the constants in my mind was the work ethic, and how it was rare when you came away from a game, win or lose, where you said, boy, the Flames they didn't work, or the compete level wasn't high, or that was a really rare occurrence this year. And compared to the year prior, where there were nights where it felt like the Flames kind of quit, and there were nights where just that was not on display on anywhere near regularly basis, or anywhere near regular a basis as it was compared to this year. And to me, that stemmed from the belief, that stemmed from, I just think that they really enjoyed playing for the guy. And I thought that shone through with the efforts and the work ethic. And that, to me, was the number one takeaway and the number one positive I had from his first year behind the bench.
Yeah, I can get behind that thought, because there were nights where the execution wasn't there for the Flames, or they were simply outskilled by the opponent. But I think you
especially
could probably...
Especially as the
year went on. But I think you could probably count the instances where the will or the compete or the fight wasn't there on one hand. And to me, that is as much a link of from the players to the coaches, but also from the coach to the leadership core of the Calgary Flames. And we heard almost at least multiple times a week over the course of the season, whether we were asking about distraction or injury or what have you, Huska gave credit to the leadership group of the Calgary Flames for navigating the waters or keeping things out of the room, so on and so forth. And I think that was a back and forth relationship between that group and the head coach. And one of the perhaps perceived criticisms of Ryan Huska's hire might have been the fact that he was inside the organization already when things went sour with Daryl Sutter. So now you're bringing in a guy that was still there, but he is such a different personality, such a different voice, that when he ended up taking over the job and had his one-on-one conversations with players and had his one-on-one conversation with Craig Conroy through the hiring process and whatnot, I think it was put to rest a little bit that, yes, this is a fresh voice. Yes, he's been with the team for 9 years at that point, but he's coming in and taking his own approach and, for lack of a better term, coming in as a breath of fresh air, whether you want to classify him as a player's coach or however you want to go about that and foil that against what Daryl Sutter was. But at the end of the day, I think after year one, and again, playoffs will be the measure. They didn't make the playoffs. They didn't come close to snatching up that final wild card spot. They were well back of the Vegas Golden Knights, but there's so much more to this. And another reason why I think he was a good hire, he's very familiar with the balance between development and winning. And his time in the AHL most definitely helped that. His time in the WHL definitely helped that. Given the direction of the organization, I think that's important and mindful to have. But he's still, at the end of the day, pushing for the results over the development, which I think is the healthy balance that you need.
Well, and I just thought that even when things were clearly going in a different direction, the fact that you could always count on them bringing that work and bringing that compete, and you always knew what you were going to get on that side of it from a Flames effort. And that just hasn't been the case, and definitely wasn't the case the year before. And I don't chalk that all up to Daryl Sutter. By no means is this me trying to say that everything that happened the year prior was all on Daryl Sutter. It wasn't. But I think we knew that a change needed to be made. And I think knowing that there was a lot of turmoil last summer and there was a lot of turmoil entering this season, and we were talking about a guy in his first year as a head coach in the NHL, I thought he did a really nice job of getting that out of him, and you never had to worry about that or question that. And I also thought, and this is something that was brought up a few times as the year went along, but I also thought that for a team that, especially as time went along, did have a talent deficit to a lot of other teams in the NHL, yep, you know, the way that this team was prepared by the coaching staff, I think Sean threw most when they played other really good teams. I mean, I think of even well after all the trades, and even they were well out of a playoff spot, the way they played against teams that were well ahead of them in the standings, like the Vancouver games or the Winnipeg game at the end of the year. You know, the Tampa Bay game they played right after the trade deadline. There just were a lot of nights where they played really good teams, played them really well. And I think that was a good piece of evidence in terms of how well prepared they were, because when you're doing a lot of video work and you're doing a lot of pre-scout work, I think it shines through when you go up against teams that are very consistent and bring it the same way night in, night out. It's a little harder to do, or maybe it shines through less when you're going up against teams with crazy variances in their game. And those crazy variances are what make them also ran teams, but I think they're harder to necessarily pre-scout for. So I want to play you this clip. This was Ryan Huska when he sat down with us in the Hot Stove Lounge on Locker Cleanout Day and talked about, you know, one thing that he was really proud of about the season, and it was how he and the staff got their team prepared.
I feel like our team was prepared every night. So, and that's something that I learned from the prior coaches that I had a chance to work with, and that's where you get your experience. So everybody, those coaches, that we all know who I'm talking about, but from Bill to Jeff to Daryl, they all brought different things to the table. But the preparation is such an important thing that you have to give your players what they need to allow them to have success. Then it's a little bit on them to make sure they do it the right way. Now it's about finding different ways to get that message across. So we're the same every night, no matter who opponent is. So we have our challenges over the course of the summer that our staff's going to have to work on and find new approaches and new ways to do things. No different than the players would when they're out on the ice working on their skills or in the gym working on their conditioning. All that stuff is the same for coaching staff, and it's things that we have to go over together and as individuals.
Just a couple of other things that I would point to as real positives from Huska in year one and things that you'd like to see carry over into year two next season. Thought there was more offensive freedom. I think that you saw that in offensive campaigns from guys like Nazem Kadri or Mackenzie Weegar or Blake Coleman. I think Kadri was the best example of it, but I just felt like offensively there was a little bit more freedom and they were a little more dangerous. And then finally, they did have a really strong penalty kill for a vast majority of the season. Again, you take away Tanev and Hanifin and Lindholm, and eventually the cumulative effect of all three of those crucial PK players took its effect, I think, in the last quarter of the season. But for three quarters of the season, this is one of the best penalty kills in the NHL, and that has been a constant, whether it's been Huska as the head coach or Huska as the defensive coach, who was very or was primarily concerned and was tasked with working on the penalty kill. That was a positive as well. Anything else you wanted to add on the positive side of things, or just add to what we talked about?
Yeah, for me, and this is for the most part, he put players in a position to succeed. You talk about Kadri and freeing up the offense for he, Mackenzie Weegar, Blake Coleman. But when Connor Zeri and Martin Pospisil came up, quickly identified Nazem Kadri was a fit, put them in position to succeed. This one took a little bit longer, and as you've mentioned a few times, there were some back issues, some illness issues, some conditioning issues with Kuzmenko, but once he got up to speed, again, found a spot for him and allowed him to flourish. Now, it didn't work universally across the board, but you can't fault Huska, for example, in finding a player with chemistry with Jonathan Huberto, for example, because he was tried almost everywhere. You look at Sharon Govich, and yeah, out of necessity, he got moved to the middle, and I think we both agree that we would prefer to see him on the wing. But for the most part, when he had a full set of assets to work with, he found combinations that allowed the Calgary Flames to, I think, succeed to their fullest.
Now, we need to also have the other side of the conversation. And I think the thing that I came away with more than anything else, it maybe took a little bit too long for them to really get comfortable with the big structural change they made from one year to the next. And look, I'm not going to sit here and break it down and be like, well, I mean, this was the reason why, and they were, you know, the gaps here. Fact of the matter is they made a big structural change in the way they defended in their own zone. And they basically, there's kind of the two polar opposites, and they flip from one to the other. And as they went from a very man coverage based defensive zone program under Daryl Sutter, which worked dynamite, it was unbelievable in year one, and then a lot of personnel changes into year two, and it was more of a, it felt like more, as opposed to a man coverage, it was more of a chasing coverage. That's kind of felt like more often than not. Guys chasing their tails, right?
Whenever there'd be a breakdown, suddenly the Calgary Flames under Daryl Sutter last season might have only allowed 20 shots a game. And I'm hyperbolating a little bit here, but there were four or five alarms.
Is hyperbolating a word?
Nope. And you had to go there. Hey?
I know, because
I was like,
awesome.
if I just say this confidently enough, I can get through without Pat questioning me.
No, I think it's a real word.
Really?
Maybe not. It's on Urban Dictionary.
Anyways, you'd only allow 20 a night, but four or five.
Hyperbolizing. Mm,
so close. Yeah. If you only allow 20, but five of them are five alarm bells, that's not a great sort of defensive system for the personnel you had. So I understand the move and the desire to alter that into a more zone defense. We'll hear from Ryan Huska here pretty shortly. It just did seem like off the jump, it was a bit of a struggle, particularly for the centers in my book.
It was really glaring in the first couple of months of the season. And Ryan Huska admitted that to Flames Talk when he sat down with us on Locker Cleanout Day.
We made a pretty significant change to the style that we played in our own zone. And I think I underestimated how long it would take them to get a grasp on it. So after we didn't have a lot of success with it, we really dug into it as a staff, and we found out what were the most important parts to really hammer on. So we made sure the players understood that. And once they got a handle on it, I think we got much better from that point.
And I do think the last bit of the season, the last even half of the season, the Flames were much better in terms of how often those high danger chances at 5-on-5 were hurting them. And I thought that was something that they did grow into. So I would expect for the guys that the holdover players on this team, the Uyghurs, the Andersons, the
Backlund,
Kadri, so on and so forth, Zeri, Coleman, all these guys, I would expect that to be in a much better place to start next season, because it clearly was a large adjustment, and all of a sudden as the reads and the switches and all those types of things became far more second nature in the second half of the season, this team, and then you throw in the fact that, okay, as they were getting the new way they want to play a little bit more down pat, then you're taking away key members of it. Again, Lindholm, Hanifin, Tanev are all key cogs in the way this team defended. So yes, as a group, they got better at defending and that became more second nature. But then I think some more of those high danger chances, 10 bell chances against, started rearing their ugly heads because you're taking away key defenders. So there, I think there was a balance there, but I do think as the year went along, they got much better in terms of the way they played without the puck.
Well, and that was going to happen when you take away what we determined anyway to be your number one center. I think Kadri would have claimed that title had Lindholm still been around, just with the way he played, but then you're also removing their top D pairing. But I also think the in-season adjustment, identifying, okay, this zone defense isn't working and executing the way that we think it should or could, he found the reoccurring issues, he hammered home the details, and I think, again, that goes back to speaking to the fact that the Flames' preparedness level was higher and their ability and attention to detail was greater. Yeah, it didn't look that way through the first 10-ish games of the season with that 2-7-1 start. But once you're able to identify where those deficiencies are and hammer home to your team as a whole, this is the structure. This is how you're executing the structure. This is how we need this to go in order for this to work effectively. I think in those sort of teaching moments, he was a real plus for the team.
And again, it's a little hard to judge just because of the fact that they lost so many players and there was such turnover in terms of the important players they had defending. But I do think that got better as the year went along. And you can't talk about year one behind the bench for Ryan Huska without talking about the power play, because
it was
such an Achilles heel for, again, 80% of the season, 85%
of the season. The last 11 games coincided roughly with Kuzmenko hitting his stride. Yeah,
Kuzmenko going red hot, all of a sudden the power play turned into a much more formidable unit, but it didn't matter. It was garbage time, and so I don't know how much stock you put into it, but under Huska and with Mark Savard running the power play, it really, really struggled and took significant steps back from what was a struggling power play. Like, how often did we talk about Kirk Muller's power play the year prior?
Right.
And it went from Muller to Savard, and the numbers and the effectiveness took a huge step back. And I don't know. I honestly don't know how sustainable or how transferable what happened in the last 10, 15 games of the season is actually going to be into next year. It was a refreshing change seeing the power play was actually scoring and producing, and maybe Kuzmenko is the kind of cog that makes the whole thing work. But you can't talk about year one under Huska without talking about the just debilitating power play that this team had for a vast majority of the year.
Well, even as good as the penalty kill was for, say, the first 75% of the season, more often than not, the Calgary Flames were still losing the special teams battle because their power play was just not operating at an acceptable clip, and it ended up costing the Flames games. It ended up costing the Calgary Flames even just momentum. It's not just not scoring. It's if the other team has a strong kill and you don't generate absolutely anything, that shifts momentum in a game. So it's not even just the fact that the power play couldn't put up the puck in the back of the net. It's basically gifting the other team some momentum so that they can get their game going again once they get back to even strength. So, yeah, that is most definitely an area that needs to be addressed in the offseason in terms of coming up with new schemes, now knowing at least to a certain extent what your personnel is going to be so that you can come up with a more effective play.
Anything on the, whether positive or negative, anything that we missed, anything that you think's important that we should touch on before we wrap things up and before we hit the text line?
I do think, and I kind of touched on it briefly, I'll get your thought on it, but I thought for the most part, everybody coming up from the Wranglers was put in a good spot in order to succeed. Nobody was placed too far up too early. I mean, again, it's easy to point to Zary and Pospisil coming up from the Wranglers and then just running with their spot. But like recalls like Solovyov, for example, Klapka, Coronado didn't find it early in the season, but even a fourth line assignment on his latest recall to end the season, he did some really good things there. So I think he did a good job meshing the prospects coming up and getting them up to speed at the NHL level.
Yeah, I think that's fair as well. I think that's an important one to point out. A few texts at 960-960. This reads, I thought the coaching hire should have been Mitch Love, but as the season went on, was surprised at how well Huska handled the team. Something I was a bit disappointed at for a defensive coach. The defense sure struggled. Was nice to have a good PK. This is from Heath, who says, there are actually fans out there calling for Huska to be let go. I've read some of their reasoning for it, and it's completely asinine. I'm actually amazed at how some people have made it this far through life. Husk has done nothing but give this team the best opportunity to be as prepared as possible for each game. You can tell the players enjoy playing for him, and they can only grow from here. I'm only laughing at the
Heath off the top rope there.
He's just absolutely drop kicking. This says from Dylan. I don't think that Huska did the best job ever at times, but all in all, I think he was good considering his experience level and having his team significantly subtracted from periodically. There's no reason at all to replace him, in my opinion. A young coach is growing with a young team. This says, C to a C+, dismal power play all year into the last few weeks. Not sure about some of the personnel issues and line combinations. This reads, Huska held this sinking ship afloat. He did an excellent job keeping the team focused and motivated. Very astute bench operator as well. There's another positive I forgot to bring up.
Yes.
I did like the accountability that he showed as well and the way that he read his team during a game. And if somebody wasn't going, they were going to know it by ice time. But then it wasn't a doghouse situation. It was, no, Steinberg, you suck on the air today. We're going to just we're going to relegate you to pushing buttons, and you can be back on the air tomorrow. It was like that was kind of what it was for. Hey, player X, you're not playing very well. You're sitting down for the third period. We're in a one-goal game. You're going to be back on your line tomorrow at practice, though.
Best example of that for me was Jonathan Huberdeau. Was that in the month of December where things just couldn't go right for Jonathan Huberdeau? And I think he was sat for a third period, came out, did his post-game address, and Ryan Huska basically threw any sort of cold water on, is this going to be tough on your relationship? Is Jonathan Huberdeau X? Is Jonathan Huberdeau Y? Just went, no, I just had to go with these guys, so on and so forth. And he did that routinely throughout the season. He was consistent in that. And if there was a situation where one line or one player or two players weren't going, he used ice time effectively to manage his roster.
And finally, this says from Big G in the country, by the time the Flames became familiar with the new coverage in their own zone, their season success was basically in jeopardy. We wrap things up on that part of the conversation. Frank Saravalli in just minutes here on Flames Talk. Aaron Vickers, Pat Steinberg along with you this hour. Coming at you from our Doug Lacey's Basement Systems downtown studio. Wet basement? They have a lasting solution to keep your basement dry. If you experience any water in your basement, contact Basement Systems. They're all things basement-y. Visit dlbasementsystems.com.
Flames Talk is on the air and streaming on the Sportsnet mobile app. Sportsnet 960 The Fan, Calgary.
It's a Tuesday edition of Flames Talk. Let's say hello to our NHL insider now. It's time to check in with Frank Saravalli, our daily face-off NHL insider. For South Trail Chrysler, where they always make the buying process simple, look for the big Canadian flag at 130th Ave or visit SouthTrailChrysler.com. Frank, safe and sound in Vancouver, I trust. You have made it back to Van after a long, arduous travel day?
Best Coast, West Coast.
Welcome welcome back to my area. Welcome back to
yeah,
my
no,
welcome
that,
back to
you
my
said
neck
that
of
for
woods.
You said that for Utah.
I know, and so Vancouver counts as well.
Get out of here. Can't even deal with your nonsense.
I thought you'd like that. Hey, before first half of this hour, we were talking about Ryan Huska. And I just wanted before we dove in on some of the other things happening around the NHL, just thought we'd kick off by getting your kind of 1,000-foot view of year one as Ryan Huska behind the Flames bench and the job that he did and how you would look at it from afar.
I would say, on the whole, if I were to grade it out, I would say Ryan Huska gets somewhere between a B and a B+. Now some people listening, I'm sure Flames fans are like, well, you know, could you have been my college professor? Like, why do you grade on such an easy scale? I think he's dealt with a lot. I think just like Craig Conroy, they were handed in perfect circumstances. I think some of the real pluses for Ryan Huska are communication and plan. He knows what he wants and he communicates it effectively, which I think is half the battle of an NHL coach. I think he's right in his assessment that had the Flames not started the year the way they did, might have had a different story to write. And we all know that not having a good start in the NHL is a death knell for your season. The first 20 games are so critical. And it's just kind of amazing now that Ryan Huska, a guy that was hired June 12th, 2023, so not quite a full year.
Yep.
He is the, I'm just doing the math. He is the 15th longest tenured coach in the league in a 32 team league. And it might be 17 or 18 by the end of this next week.
Yeah. Yep. I think for year one, we gave him fairly favorable reviews just based on all of, as you talked about, there were some difficult circumstances. You're dealing with all kinds of roster turnover, all kinds of distractions. Yeah. I thought he did a fairly admirable job in year one and was kind of the guy that Craig Conroy had earmarked as his guy right from the start. And they seem like they had a pretty good working relationship. So there's lots of things that are going to be challenges for him going forward with this roster. But I thought all things considered a pretty solid year one for Huska behind the bench.
Yeah. And the other thing I would add too is also his first year as an NHL head coach.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's lots of things that he would learn and do differently. There's a bunch of other guys that were, you know, NHL coaches in new cities, Patrick Waugh and Peter Laviolette and John Hines. Like, there's been a lot of guys that are new faces in new places, but didn't also have to do two things. One, which is go from being the assistant to the head guy, which is never easy. And two, doing it in your first career NHL job with a rebuilding team three, it's not going to be perfect. No one's expecting it to be perfect. So that's where they're at.
Okay. So that was the quick Flames question. I wanted to kick things off with you, but let's jump into some coaching news around the NHL, because it was Monday. We found out Seattle made the decision to move on from Dave Hakstol as head coach. The first coach in Seattle history is now no longer with the organization. What, from your understanding, why was this the decision made? Why did the Kraken decide to move away from Hakstol behind the bench?
I think part of it was frustration or friction with players. You saw the Emily Kaplan report that multiple players had expressed in exit interviews that they simply didn't want to play for him anymore. That's certainly damning, but I don't think it's something that Ron Francis is necessarily going to react to just that. He mentioned the idea that he didn't like the inconsistency this year and also some of the losing skids that Seattle was on that they were never able to pull out of. I think this is an interesting choice because Seattle overachieved last year. I think that's fact. I don't think that's opinion. They had almost everyone have career years. They win around, knock off the defending cup champs in their second year of franchise existence. And 1 year later, when everyone regresses back to the mean, like we thought they would, that's the year you decide to gong your head coach. Like, it just doesn't necessarily compute for me. And I think what it also does is put some pressure squarely on Ron Francis, because this is an entirely mediocre team. They are mediocre in roster construction, in every facet, scoring, whatever goaltending, whatever it might be, how do you find a way to find difference makers? And until that happens, like, you could put Scotty Bowman on the bench. Like, I don't think it matters. Pick the best coach you think in NHL history. I don't know that you're going to get entirely different results than what they've gotten.
Yeah. Okay. And what's happening in Pittsburgh right now? What are we feeling when it comes to Mike Sullivan's future there?
Well, that's a good question. I would say the answer is clouded at the moment, or cloudy. There's been some real friction, I think, between GM Kyle Dubas and coach Mike Sullivan in that I think the GM is looking for some changes to the coaching staff and in terms of assistant coaches. And I think there's been some real pushback from the coach saying, hey, look, I've been here a long time, a lot longer than you. I've won 2 Stanley Cups here. I've been a successful head coach and I know what I want. And I think that's gone around and around in circles. I don't know what the end game is or how it's going to play out. I think it's a little bit too soon to say.
Okay.
But what I can say for certain is that if Mike Sullivan becomes available somehow, whether it's a firing, whether it's a settlement and we part and go our separate ways, whatever it might be, I would expect that the New Jersey Devils and Tom Fitzgerald would be at the very front of the line for Mike Sullivan.
Okay. And that is interesting to watch as we move forward. We're chatting with Frank Saravalli, our daily Faceoff NHL insider. And that moves us to coaches that are still technically coaching. Frank, what's going to happen? Technically is correct. They're still actually coaching is what I meant to say. What's going to happen with Sheldon Keefe in Toronto if they don't pull off the miracle comeback against Boston?
I have a really hard time envisioning a path for Sheldon Keefe to come back as coach.
Okay. How come?
I think part of it is just this is year 8 of Austin Matthews and friends in the playoffs, and Sheldon Keefe is one of the 5 longest tenured coaches in the NHL. At some point, it's just time to make a change. I haven't loved his demeanor behind the bench, and I feel like at every turn, there's some kind of excuse, whether it's been the officials night after night or whether it's saying that Austin Matthews chasing 70 goals is a major distraction. That was an exact quote, major distraction. He also, at varying points during the season, have blamed the media for poor performance by his players, including Ilya Samsonov. That thought process, that comportment, that public persona, that attitude for a team that is, looks to me at least, to be entirely lost, I don't know how that could be your leader.
So what else, and I fully hear that on Sheldon Keefe, what else could happen here? We're talking about, you mentioned it, year 8 for Austin Matthews. Obviously, Mitch Marner is a massive hot button topic for Maple Leafs fans right now. There's a lot of talk about Brendan Shanahan. What else might happen if what feels for many inevitable does end up coming to pass?
I do love, by the way, that Ryan Reeves was out there saying, hey, aren't we dealing with the same Boston team that blew a 3-1 series lead last year in the first round? I mean, crazier things have happened. I don't see this Leaf team having any of the same
right
heart or fight that Florida team did.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, what's on the table? Everything should be on the table. I think, you should really go back to the drawing board with a new president at MLSE to say, what are we doing here? What's our path? Have we taken the right approach? If not, what would we change? I think that includes coach. I think that includes core players. I think that includes senior management. Whatever the case might be, you should be in full evaluation mode because whatever they're doing isn't working. And it's not just this team is cursed. It's not you can't win in Toronto. Tell me why they can't. Why is it that the theory or theme always seems to be, oh, but look at the division that they're in. First, it's Tampa. Now it's Florida. Right. And then it's Boston. And it's like, well, at what point are you going to be the same scary team to everyone else? Why can't you be the team that everyone's afraid of?
Right.
And that's kind of why I love Florida knocking off Tampa last night. I love what Matthew Tkachuk said after the game, which was, I got here 2 years ago and we were looking up to a team like Tampa saying, how can we be them? And now this year we're beating them.
Mm-hmm.
That's real growth. That's real progress. That's how you change an organization. Toronto Maple Leafs, since 1967, you're on deck.
What are the most, from a personnel standpoint, what would you, and I'm at risk of radioing you here, so I apologize, but what are the most likely moves they would make? Like, would this whole the entire storm surrounding Mitch Marner, would that be a guy who could potentially no longer be in Toronto after this season?
Sure. Look, I'm not afraid of being radioed. I'll just give you my full-blown thought process and opinion, which For sure. is I think you have to make a really simple and clear determination. Before Brad Trueliving got there for years, the fear that the Toronto Maple Leafs have twisted themselves into a pretzel trying to think about has been, well, these are really good players that things just haven't worked out for. And if we trade one of them and break up this core, we're risking losing the trade and making our team look bad. I think it's so much more simple than that. It goes back to exactly the same black and white thought process that I have when talking about the Calgary Flames.
Yeah.
Do you want to be here or not? For the Toronto Maple Leafs, it's, are you helping us win in the playoffs or not? And if you are Mitch Marner and you're not helping us in the playoffs and you clench up in a sphincter tightening Stanley Cup playoff series, you're not helping us. It's great that you care and are invested, but I'm going to go out and find people that are going to help us.
Yep.
I want difference makers. I want Matthew Tkachuks, not to rub it in, but how many more players have more playoff points than Matthew Tkachuk over the last few years? Do you know the answer?
I don't.
There's only two, and they're Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl.
Okay, so pretty good.
Yeah. You want difference makers. Mitch Marner, he's not helping the Toronto Maple Leafs win. So it'd be super easy for me to walk through that process of, now, what can we do to make the trade? And instead of being afraid and approaching it from that perspective, start looking at it as what you can do differently and what kind of savings you might have from a cap perspective to be able to go out and change the construction of this roster once and for all.
Right. He's Frank Saravalli, our Daily Faceoff NHL insider. He joins us Tuesdays on Flames Talk. You mentioned Tampa Bay out in five against the defending Eastern Conference champion Florida Panthers. What does your gut say on the future of Steven Stamkos with the Lightning?
It doesn't really say anything because I don't have enough information yet.
Okay.
What I know is the Tampa Bay Lightning haven't made Steven Stamkos an offer at any point on a contract extension. That's really bothered him. I understand why that's bothered him, because he's been a career-long Lightning player. They're also at an inflection point for their roster. I look at it and I say they've got a couple years left without first-round picks, with Victor Hedman and others having years left on their deals. Might as well at least try and go for it and see if you can sneak through in a year that you don't get Florida in the first round or whatever it might be. Can you be a better regular season team? And by the way, in parentheses, John Cooper entering his last year of his deal could be another coaching change. Are they signing him to an extension or not? with Stamkos, like, he's done the dance before, he's left and done the interviews, but he's never actually gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's insulted that after helping deliver two cups, that he should have been given more consideration. It's just that I don't know what direction this team's going to go in. Julian Breezeball is a wild card, and I think he wanted to know what happened with this season first before charting a path forward, which I think is pretty reasonable and understandable.
Okay. Washington, the only team swept in round one, and some news about TJ Oshie and some uncertainty about TJ Oshie for next season. What do we know there?
Yeah, so his back has been a chronic issue. There's no surprise there. He's 37 years old, and his body hasn't really cooperated. There's also been, to be fair, a pretty sizable or noticeable drop in his game and his speed. That part hasn't helped. I think when you look at Washington and where they're at, it's, you heard the press conference from Brian McClellan last year when he said, I don't know how Nicklas Backstrom can compete with his, remember his hip issues that he had?
Yep.
And how significant of a surgery that was. And Backstrom basically went into the summer trying to prove him wrong and came back to start the year. And then that was it. Mm-hmm. Had to turn out the lights. And I think just from Washington's perspective alone, whatever happens with Oshie one way or the other, come back and play the final year of your deal at 5.7 or not, just have a plan and stick with it, because the worst thing that you want as a manager is to start the year with a player and not finish with him, because it's LTIR money that you could have spent in the summer that you didn't.
Yeah. Just a couple more thoughts on the Stanley Cup playoffs. How about Dallas going into Vegas, one of the hardest places to play in the NHL, down 0-2 and winning twice? Like, good on Vegas for going into Dallas, but the Stars with their backs against the wall to do that the other way in Vegas. What did we learn about this Dallas team the last two games?
Honestly, I'm not certain all that much. They were the best road team in the NHL this season, 26-10-5. Maybe we discounted that part of it. I estimate, just from pure eyeball eye test, that Dallas has controlled somewhere between 65 to 70% of the series. They've clearly been the better team. They didn't get the results the first two games. They prevailed in the cauldron, and we're probably having a different conversation if Wyatt Johnson, we might even be having a series right now if Wyatt Johnson doesn't score an OT.
Yep.
So Johnson is another reminder of their depth. And I like, look, was I nervous after the first two games because Dallas was my cup pick? Yeah. Be honest. I mean, that it's not a good look opening up 0-2 at home to the defending cup champs with Mark Stone back. But they're a really good team that doesn't have very many weaknesses. You see Tanev, again, another puck off the face in warmups, still in the lineup. he's a beast.
Yep.
And I think he's added a different element to that team that I really like. Like, they've got every angle of the game covered. Speed, skill, size, toughness, efficiency, anything that you, any way they want to, the game needs to be played, they're ready to play it that way.
By the way, what was your estimation on how much Dallas had controlled?
Somewhere between 65 and 70%.
Pretty close. I mean, over at Natural Stat Trick, they've got them at 64% on expected goals. So
that's expected goals. I just think in terms of carrying the play and domination, I think it's even higher than that.
I just was giving you credit for your eyeball, that's all. And
it's almost like I do this for a living.
That's why I want. I like.
It's so wild that that works, right?
I like to underline these things and make sure that we can empower our friends. That's all. Vancouver and Edmonton. What's your feel? Do they both wrap up their series on home ice in five games?
I'm gonna go out on a limb and say all four series that have clinching games tonight end tonight.
Okay.
I'm in Vancouver. There is serious incentive and motivation for that team to wrap it up. As JT Miller said, what's on the line? 8.5 hours of more flying. No one wants to do that. And I think the Canucks are a little bit banged up. They could use the rest, and they could really use to not give a Nashville team that's outplayed them this series any life.
Yep. Edmonton get it done on Wednesday night?
I think so, yeah. I think they're just in a different class than the Kings.
Even more so than the last 2 years, hey?
Way more. Game one and game three just showed you that when Edmonton turns it on, they're way better than that team. They finally got a goaltending performance from Stuart Skinner, perfectly timed, and I think they're going to be a real handful for someone.
Yep. Edmonton, Vancouver. If that ends up being the way this goes, are you staying in Western Canada?
I am.
Okay.
I'm in your neighborhood.
Yeah, you're basically.
I'm just going to move into the old Steinberg residence.
Yeah, it's like hop, skip, and a jump. Okay, before I lose any more teeth, have a wonderful rest of your Tuesday. Enjoy the atmosphere. Game five in Vancouver. Hey, thanks as always. We'll talk next week. Thank you, pal.
Did you really lose a tooth?
No.
Is that why you were like, excuse me?
No, I coughed on. Coughed.
I was like, he's over there stroking out on me. What's happening here? Am I gonna have to do this hit alone and just talk until nothing is enough?
That would be interesting.
No, it wouldn't. Trust me.
Might be better than hearing me. We'll talk to you next week.
See you, Pat.
Bye, buddy. Frank Saravalli, Daily Faceoff, NHL Insider. He joins us Tuesdays on Flames Talk. That's how we wrap up this hour. Thanks to Cam. Thanks to Shan, our producers this hour. And as always, Frank Saravalli brought to you by South Trail Chrysler, where they always make the buying process simple. Look for the big Canadian flag at 130th Ave or visit SouthTrailChrysler.com.